democracy, to be sustained, always works through institutions.
In der letzten Folge haben wir festgestellt, dass Demokratie nicht selbstverständlich ist.
In order to make America great and glorious again.
Great and glorious, great and glorious, great and glorious,
great and glorious. Great and glorious again.
I am tonight announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
In der letzten Folge sprachen wir mit David Frum über die Gefahren, die Populismus für demokratische Strukturen darstellt. Und vor allem darüber, dass demokratische Institutionen gepflegt und beschützt werden müssen. Gegen Gefahren von außen sowie von innen. Und damit willkommen zur Atlantic Hour und unserem zweiten Gespräch über den Zustand unserer liberalen Demokratie.
And those of you who are familiar with it, know that in America democracy is hypocrisy.
Gesellschaften verändern sich. Und wir reden darüber. Mit Gästen aus Politik, Wissenschaft und aus der Gesellschaft. In der heutigen Folge sprechen wir mit Therese Mager. Therese ist Populismus-Expertin und hat für uns eine Podiumsdiskussion mit David Frum moderiert. Wir blicken auf ihre Konversation mit Frum zurück und sprechen über Schnittpunkte zwischen populistischen Bewegungen in Amerika und Europa.
Could you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Christoph. Yes, my name is Therese Mager. I am a researcher at the Research Institute for Social Cohesion, as well as the Research Center for Global Dynamics at Leipzig University. My research is about the populist far right in France, and I also study their connection with other far right movements in Europe and beyond. I'll also mention that I'm originally from the United States, but that I've lived for quite some time in Europe, actually. I lived for some years in France, and I spent 1 year in Belgium before moving to Leipzig 5 years ago.
Okay, so the reason why we have you here today is because you, not only are you a researcher here in Leipzig, but also you were moderating a conversation that we had with David Frum by now, I think, 2 weeks ago. And we've had you come in today to sort of remember some of the things that we talked about with Mr. Frum and explore these points a little bit further. So without any further ado, I'll just jump right in, if that's okay for you.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Okay, so Frum offers the term fascioid to describe today's fascist-like movements. So my question to you would be, how has today's fascism departed from that of the 20th century, which is sort of what we refer to when we talk about fascism? And how has it changed in such a way to accommodate today's political environment?
Right. So, yeah, David put the word fascioid in his most recent book, Trumpocalypse, part of which I read in preparation for the event. And what he was trying to suggest was that different far-right authoritarian stakeholders were like interwar early 20th century fascists, but not quite. So we could call them fascioid, so as not to lose track of what the roots of their language and approaches are. So I don't want to try and explain how Donald Trump's approach to leadership or that of Marine Le Pen or Viktor Orban is or is not like 20th century fascism. And let's not forget that there are significant differences between these different leaders. I think that could be a long discussion. There are clear distinctions, there are clear similarities. But for now, I'll just put a pin in that. I just would say on the subject that words really matter and that the words we use to talk about these kinds of stakeholders matter. It's really a balancing act for scholars. I mean, genuinely, it really is something that we, people who work on the far right and extremism, ask themselves a lot. And it's, I suppose, a balancing act for journalists as well. I do believe it is, and it should be. On the one hand, we don't want to dilute what the word fascist means or to trivialize it, though, as you can imagine, this is already happening. I think maybe the word is used very widely without much consideration for historical context. And on the other hand, we want to avoid normalizing people and their politics, I mean, far-right stakeholders in their politics, by using words that are imprecise or positively connoted or otherwise confusing. For example, I mentioned to you before we started recording the podcast that I was at a conference this week It was at the German Center for Integration and Migration Research and was about the normalization or the mainstreaming of the far right. One of the researchers who presented her work, Dr. Katie Brown, is doing research with Dr. Aurélien Mondon about how we talk about the far right. And they both make the point that we have to be careful with the term populist, which I think I already screwed up in our recording. but we understand this term conceptually. Maybe you and I understand it conceptually. We've read about it. I've certainly read about it a lot for my own research, and I find it useful. But it's clear that it means something different to different people and can be quite confusing. So you might have noticed that during our event with David Frum, he asked why we call regressive or authoritarian stakeholders populist when they're not popular or popular to the point of winning solid majorities. That's not what the term means. That's not the reason that we use it. But if David Frum, as well-read as he is, doesn't see the logic and the history there, then I can imagine the term is meaningless at best for a lot of the general public. So we have to think about which terms we use. I have to think about which terms I use and with whom and how we qualify them. And for my part, and because as scholars we have time to explain ourselves sometimes, I think it's incumbent upon us to contextualize wherever possible and to use precise terminology if we can. It's maybe the boring approach. It's not the trendy way to go in a culture of hot takes, but it seems to me to be the most responsible solution. So for myself, in a scholarly setting, I prefer to say far right or far right populist and to offer historical and present day context to draw the distinctions but also the similarities. So again, I will say that this has to be considered carefully depending on whom I'm talking to. This is kind of a different subject, but for example, words like far right mean something very different in Germany than they do in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So those are just, whereas, for example, in France, the word populist, I have the impression, is just a word that's now used in the media and political context to just talk about anyone you don't like. Mm-hmm. It's kind of just a political cudgel. You say, well, he's populist, she's populist, as a way to say anti-democratic, demagogic, without making it clear mm-hmm. what's meant or what that implies.
So kind of as a catch-all phrase that stands in for all of these negative attributes.
Yeah, it stands for a lot of negative attributes, knowing that, I mean, there's a fair bit of research about populism as something emancipatory. The earliest populist movements in the United States, for example, were responses to deep-seated corruption, to an impression that there was little representativity for normal people, for average people. It certainly wasn't similar to some of the far-right variants that we see in Europe today, or it was very much removed from that, not rhetorically, but in terms of content. I think that it... No, I'm going to stop talking because I don't know enough about this. But yeah.
Being stuck with the label far-right is very damning, and it's very, very negative. Could you maybe elaborate on what that's like in the US? Because that's certainly something that always struck me. How everybody was always talking about, like, oh yeah, for instance, the Republican Party, you know, like, tends to be center-right or more to the right, which is something that you wouldn't want to be attributed to your party in a German context.
Well, I will say, first of all, that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I sometimes get the impression that in Germany, something might say just plain old right or right wing, and that this is already kind of not so great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
That's certainly surprising from an American perspective. I would say just a term like right wing or on the right, conservative, these are all totally fine, or at least they're accepted, they're mainstream. Saying something like far right, extreme right, radical right, there's not, in my experience, and as a layperson, there's not a very good education about what that could mean. It's not really understood. I don't even really think it carries a connotation. Maybe the word extreme or extremist you hear that and you think, well, I mean, that sounds bad. Nobody really wants to be labeled extremist. But it certainly is not a word that would strike fear into people's hearts, maybe in the same way that it might over here. Conversely, you talk about a radical leftist perspective. You talk about a far left or an extreme left perspective. That's very negatively connoted, and it has been for a long time. I mean, this idea of being communist, this is changing over generations, but it's been extremely negatively connoted. You could not become a politician, and you can barely become a politician while claiming to be a democratic socialist. That's only changed in the last few years with characters or figures like Bernie Sanders and Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez. So that's brand new, really. Brand new in our 21st century and late 20th century. Even though socialism and communism, so to speak, have their own U.S.-American homegrown variants that did exist and that were eventually stamped out and then completely maligned in every way.
So Frum argued that after the war, citizens of war-torn Europe managed to accept this new world order that was about to come and sort of to overcome the feeling that their best days had been behind them. That Frum argued that the way that Europeans got over this is through economic prosperity that spread across the continent. And sort of that prosperity was the way for people to move away from these populist movements. So considering that today people in America and Europe live in relative prosperity, my question to you would be, what makes them susceptible to the far-right movements today? Or like, who are people who are part of these movements and what do they want?
So this is a really interesting question from my point of view. I haven't studied it in depth, but I have thought quite a lot about this question in regards to my own research, which is about the far right and political developments in France. It's true that people in the US and Europe live in relative prosperity today, and there are many ways we could measure this. But there are also real shifts that are happening in terms of people's lived experiences, in terms of a general discourse or even a paradigm, which are negative, simply put. And this translates into narratives of decline. I think this is really an interesting topic, and I'd love to write a paper about it sometime. So for me, it's front and center, because in France in particular, there's something of a historic obsession with national decline, and it's been very prevalent there over recent decades. The first and main reason in the French case, but also here in Germany, is economic. So in the 30 or so years following World War II, the only way for much of Europe was up. It was a period of ascent, and these were times of economic growth. In the French case, an economic slump set in more or less long-term in the mid-70s, and while a lot of the economic conditions we saw in the 80s and 90s have improved in terms of the numbers, it's come at the cost of other things. At the cost of well-functioning public services and a sense of security or a sense that the state will provide. Just for anybody who's interested in French things at all, in French, the word for the welfare state is l'état-providence, which means the providence state, almost like providence, like God, like the state that provides. So it's this very top-down perception of the relationship between individuals and their providing state. And so there's a very widespread impression across the population that France's best days are behind them. And so my question to you, I mean, perhaps you could answer me, is this not true for Germany as well? I've certainly read about the economic malaise that set in Germany in the early 2000s and about how journalistic and political discourses at the time focused heavily on Standort Deutschland, on this idea of Germany as a desirable site for economic activity. Basically, and the question was exactly the same on a political level in France, the question is, how can Germany remain competitive in a globally interconnected world? It's a very neoliberal narrative, but it clearly holds weight, and average people feel the effects of this malaise. So just to give an example, in early September of this year, I saw a cover of Der Spiegel, which showed the GDP growth of several countries of interest for Germans, several European countries, the United States, Japan, as opposed to Germany, which has recently experienced a small dip in GDP. So I don't know about you, but I've been hearing a fair bit over the last year about Germany headed into a recession. And the cover of the Spiegel article said, "Everyone's creating growth, but not us." In German, it was "Alle schaffen Wachstum, wir nicht." Mm-hmm. And I had to laugh to myself because this kind of "woe is us, our model is failing" discourse is really prevalent in France as well. It's something we can see in many places. And then, you know, not to dive into it too deep, but I've talked to my colleague, Dr. Man Zhang, here in Leipzig. She's also at the Research Institute for Social Cohesion. And I asked her about narratives of decline in China, which is her region of research. And she said, oh, yes, absolutely. You know, I think that the way that China is represented in the media is as a place of where the government has control of everything, has this web that they're very carefully and easily controlling, and certainly it's an authoritarian state. It doesn't function the way that Germany or the United States does. But there is also a bit of a panic happening, I think, about the direction the country is going, because some things are simply out of control. So to give a very simple analogy, in Germany we hear talk about the demographics of the future. The question is, there, you know, an aging population means a lot of people will go into retirement at some point, and they'll leave the active labor force, and we'll need more people to support them. And so this seems like an upcoming crisis. This question is so much more severe in China because of the kind of demographic manipulation they've been doing mm-hmm. over the last few decades. We can obviously think of the one-child policy. So it's also something that's freaking them out, to put it simply. And in a lot of ways, this fear of decline, the fear of the best days being behind us, this has gripped a lot of places. And perhaps for a number of reasons, not least of which that people want to sell newspapers and get people listening to their radio shows or watching their television shows. I mean, this narrative of crisis and of decline is widespread, is my guess.
And I mean, it also has a kind of cohesive character to it. A lot of these decline narratives then create like an in-group kind of identity who's being manipulated or is going down, and through this ostensibly universal experience of going down, they like form one unit again, or at least that's kind of the impression that I have from an Eastern German perspective. Or these kind of narratives of decline will feature with people saying like, oh yeah, you know, like with now, like beginning in 2015, for instance, people were saying we will be as bad off as the West. Leipzig will look like Düsseldorf in just 2 years if we keep having this many refugees, and then mm-hmm. everything's going down, you know. And I think these kind of narratives are very much based on, okay, this who's going down here is me and my people, and is thus, I think, so powerful because it like creates this in-group identity.
It's really an opportunity for the far right. I mean, that's the declinist narrative that the far right has lived on, has fed off of for the last, 40 years in France, 50 years in France, really. And then we're seeing the same thing happening here with the AfD. This is their bread and butter. And they will, you know, this is something I was writing about yesterday, which is... this is the sense of loss of control that people have, a sense of insecurity, a loss of solid footing, and of a supposedly well-defined and homogeneous identity. So, and I don't want to deny people's lived experiences, but again, I think that politicians, including mainstream politicians, and especially media organizations, have a role in fomenting a sense of insecurity and of civilizational clash, which I particularly dislike. So yeah, this is what I was just saying, more or less. I think the far right really lives and breathes civilizational clash. Their arguments and their reasoning rely on binaries, on in-groups and out-groups, and these are intensified and made into reality in ways which benefit these far right actors, as well as mainstream actors who see an opportunity. I think that I could cite, for example, maybe some politicians from the CDU here in Germany, for example, who think that maybe the way forward or the way to gain a certain electorate is to speak to people's fears with regard to migration. Mm-hmm.
Mostly what my issue is a lot of reductionist arguments, always saying, oh, it's, you know, male working class people who vote for these, because then it, yeah, I feel like it just reduces the issue to like make it about class and education, and kind of doesn't really actually get into the nitty-gritty of what gets, you know, what moves people to vote for certain parties.
It's sort of... Yeah, placing a certain blame on people or shaming them. And then conversely, we talk about it like it's this this fantastic candidate that just has so much pull on people without considering all the ways that that candidate's discourses are relayed in media, relayed by other politicians, how they're mainstreamed, because they genuinely are, and we can see this phenomenon everywhere in the world. So these are problems. I have just to take it back to the question of, you know, who are the kinds of people who vote for Marine Le Pen? I have a good friend back in southwestern France who said, every day I hear on the radio, there's talking about, you know, the kinds of people who support the Front National, the Rassemblement National, and they're always bringing up all of these characteristics that basically describe me. You know, he's an electrician. We know each other because of doing music together, but he's... got sort of the profile of the kind of person who supports Le Pen. He doesn't see himself that way at all. He supports left-wing parties, and then some. You know, in France, there's quite a gamut when it comes to left-wing parties. But he says, sometimes I just feel so, yeah, pigeonholed that I want to say, well, fine, you know, if that's how you see me, then I guess I will. That's just an anecdote. But it's important to avoid stigmatizing people. I think it's the far right's game, right? To make people feel excluded and to set people up to feel divisions and to feel distrust in the hopes of gaining followers. But we can't forget that there are what we would call mainstream stakeholders that do the same thing as well. It doesn't do to pit people against each other based on class and education. I think that's a failing that we're seeing in many different places.
Then my last question to you, which is meant to sort of end on a positive note, but it's a very broad question and very difficult to answer. So I hope that I'm not doing you a disservice by putting you in a position of where you have to get out of your depth potentially. So... what was particularly eye-opening to me when Fram spoke was that he emphasized the very tremendous achievement that is the inception of the European Union, the coming together after centuries of war to become one unit, and as unperfect as it is and as much arguing as there is about the legitimacy of the Union, who gets to decide what in terms of international versus national interests. But the fact that we have general prosperity and peace across most of Europe, I think, is a tremendous achievement. So my question to you would be, are there lessons that can be learned from this European experiment, so to say, in today's political climate? Sort of what people did in the 20th century in coming together to form the European Union? Are there any lessons that could serve today's political environment?
So the European Union is a fantastic achievement and an exciting achievement, and one which I believe, at least in a political sense, most people can get behind. I think it's also, for those Americans that are familiar with it, because it's a little bit of a confusing concept, I think, from the United States perspective. When people understand what it is and the purpose of it, of course, it seems it's very romantic. Actually, it's romantic in the sense of idealistic, mm-hmm. right? From there, from this romantic or this idealistic starting point, we can mention, of course, that there are aspects of the European Union and of EU integration which people have difficulty supporting or simply don't understand, or which isn't explained to them because it's not politically useful. For the governments in power. So I think that for a long time, blaming Brussels was an easy strategy for deflecting criticism. And as a consequence, many constituents might feel that the European Union is not representative and not democratically accountable. And between you and me, you know, in what ways is it? It has one elected organ, the European Parliament, which is famously kind of ineffectual or weak. And I've heard the argument made that the EU was not meant to be representative, so to speak, or democratic, but that it was a technocratic organization meant to seek out harmonization on different levels and improve cooperation across borders. I think EU citizens enjoy many material benefits because of this, and they probably don't take enough time to reflect on what those are or hear enough about them. But the EU also has real impacts on people's lives. And so many people might have a hard time understanding how that's possible when they don't really have a say in the decisions and directives issued by the EU. And this is, I guess, a problem that we see, or that at least is felt in our liberal democracies more broadly. So the answer to that, in my personal opinion, is obviously not to do away with the EU or to dismantle it, because I don't see a better possibility. Mm-hmm. I think that European countries are obviously stronger together. And I think that a majority of Europeans believe this too. So the answer to that, in my personal opinion, is to consider some institutional reforms, if I can say that. I think that's important on the national level too, and I don't use the term lightly. I don't want to see every country's constitution thrown out or the EU treaties scrapped or anything like that, but democratic institutions might need some tweaking to keep up with the times. And there are challenges today that our democratic ancestors or forebears couldn't have predicted. So the proliferation of information sources, you know, there's a truth for anyone, for anything, if you want to look for it. It's not like the old days where there used to be just a few public television stations and a few public radio stations. I mean, thanks to the internet, there's anything is possible. There's also the challenge of artificial intelligence. To use an example that listeners might be familiar with from the United States, there's the development of the assault-style weapons problem. That's not something that the U.S. Constitution was built around or that the framers of it could have expected. And our institutions may not allow us to engage sufficiently in view of expectations today, in view of people's expectations for participation, for representation, and act in a way that will help us feel safe and seen and represented. To be repetitive, sorry about that. And I really strongly believe in the idea of self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. I think that it's okay to try to expect a lot out of people in democracies. It's okay to expect a lot out of citizens, or ask them to show more engagement or more responsibility if they can also feel in turn respected and represented. I think there's work that can be done on this in Germany, in France, in the United States, for example. And we shouldn't write people off or diminish them and their commitment to a well-functioning society. I'm one of these people who really prefer, maybe just for my own peace of mind, to expect that other people are actually fundamentally good, mm-hmm. that we're fundamentally social, that we want to be good to each other and behave in a way that will make our society function well together. I think the vast majority of people aren't trying to screw things up for each other. And that it would be nice to see this expectation of the best from one another in our political lives.
Unser Gespräch mit Therese hat gezeigt, dass Sprache wichtig ist. Wie wir Dinge bezeichnen, formt unser Verhältnis zu ihnen. Generalisierte und unpräzise Beschreibungen können dabei häufig den Kern von Problemen verschwimmen lassen. Politische Gegner einfach als Faschisten zu bezeichnen, reduziert zum Beispiel die emotionalisierte Erfahrung von Verlustnarrativen, die Amerikaner und Europäer nach rechts rücken lässt. Um solche Diskussionen produktiver zu machen, müssen wir also versuchen, eine präzisere Sprache miteinander zu finden. Denn nur so können wir das Vertrauen in unsere demokratische Ordnung erhalten. Und damit kommen wir zum Ende unserer Gespräche über den Zustand unserer Demokratie. Wir bedanken uns noch einmal herzlich bei unseren Gesprächsgästen David Frum und Therese Mager. Die Atlantic Hour ist eine Produktion des Deutsch-Amerikanischen Instituts Sachsen mit Musik von mir, Christoph Nostitz. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal.